Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. No Bears theme music to kick off this week after...
There it is.
Wow.
It was such a good first half, wasn't it?
Not much to celebrate at the end of it. Yeah, there. That sort of started to slow down and fade when Aaron Rodgers pulled his Willis Reed in the second half.
Thought he was injured.
He wasn't faking it.
No, I know, but I thought he was out for the game.
Yeah.
Possibly the season. And my heart broke a little bit for him because I feel bad. You know, everybody loves Aaron Rodgers.
Usually, if you get carted off, you're not back in the second half, particularly when you're a $134 million player and essentially the franchise. You don't want to risk it. But I'll tell you what, that's a game that was a heartbreaker for the Bears, but it's one you'll remember when Aaron Rodgers is giving his induction speech in Canton. That was some performance because, you know, frankly, on the other side of the ball, Khalil Mack, he lived up to the advanced billing. He lived up to two first round draft picks. And
who's that Hicks guy? Number 98. He's a beast. I told Peyton, I go, watch this guy, watch him do what he's doing. I mean, he never took his eye off the ball. He was so impressive. But of course, my kids, oh, we're going to the Super Bowl, Mom. Really, hey, guys. It's not even, the first half isn't even over yet.
Yeah.
Slow your roll, because this is what the Bears do. They break your heart. They get you back. They suck you back in, and then they break your heart.
Well, I mean, it was a lot of fun to watch, and Trubisky, I think, is coming along. I mean, I think the Bears, I'm a little bit encouraged by the performance yesterday, even though they're going to have to get over giving that game away, so to speak. I mean, Aaron Rodgers really took it away, but Trubisky...
He was
composed. He made smart decisions. Defense looked solid. So, you know.
75-yard return at the beginning. I thought, this is going to be it.
Of course.
We're going to go all the way.
Yeah, the only problem is, of course, nobody's watching the NFL anymore. So,
well, everybody was watching the Miss America pageant.
Yeah, well.
There's a split screen, you know, where we could try and watch both.
So, on Thursday night, the Atlanta-Philadelphia NFL opener was down 13% off last year's opener, which was down 11% over the previous year's opener. So you really have some attrition. And this weekend, of course, you had more kneeling going on, and that gets a lot of attention. Three Miami Dolphins kneeling during the
episode. I call them three pansies. And then one stood up, but then he put his fist up in the air. They shouldn't even show that. Who cares?
I don't know if even diehard Bears fans even care about a Bears-Packers rivalry game anymore. I don't know if they care about a Lambeau Field. I don't know if they care about a Mitch Trubisky or a Khalil Mack or a Roquan Smith. I just don't know. 312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA turnkey.pro text line. Are you so upset with the NFL, with Kaepernick and Nike, that you're not even going to watch the Bears anymore?
There's other teams I might not watch, but I can't not watch the Bears. I mean, it's just not physically possible for me not to make that appointment television. Because it's part of our culture. It's part of our fabric of our life. Sundays, you watch football, you know, with the family.
Mm-hmm.
And you watch the game. I mean, there was no way that you weren't going to watch, right?
Yeah, I did watch it. I'm in fantasy and all kinds of other stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to watch. I mean, that's probably the only reason I do watch.
Yeah, how many fantasy football leagues are you in?
Especially after the Steelers tied the Browns.
Can I ask you a question about this?
It's a tough start.
I know they played an extra quarter. Why don't you keep playing until there's a winner? This is very soccer-ish to have a tie in football.
It's very rare. That's the difference between football and soccer, among others, you know, use of hands, scoring. But
No, I don't know how long you've been watching football, but there's always been one overtime and...
And that's it.
And that's it. Yeah. Okay. So there's been ties before.
It's different rules in college, though.
It is now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So I'm not crazy.
Colin Catwell.
Well.
That's a separate question.
312-642-5600.
Speaking of Kaepernick, Tiger Woods, he's not going to take the bait on Trump, but he will take it on Nike because he wants to keep that sweet lucre flowing in. Asked about Nike's decision to make Kaepernick the face of their Just Do It campaign, Woods said, I think Nike's trying to get out ahead of it and trying to do something special, and I think they've done that. It's a beautiful spot, this extended spot that features Kaepernick's VO, and pretty powerful people in the spot. Woods said he had no, you know, they didn't tell him it was coming, and they don't run decisions by him that are not golf-related or Woods-related, but he was, you know, sort of upbeat on the matter, and apparently so is the audience to whom Nike is trying to market.
What's online sales are up 31%.
Yeah, so.
But one place where sales aren't doing well, there's a small Missouri college. I'm sure you're familiar with College of the Ozarks.
Yeah, we talked about it.
Oh, you did? That they're removing the logo from there, or they're not going to let them wear those uniforms.
No Nike at College of the Ozarks, and get back to work. That's the college that has the mandatory work program as part of your academic experience at College of the Ozarks.
Really?
They could be onto something there. All right, we're going to stick with the intersection of sports and politics here.
What's the name of that segment?
The intersection.
Section of sports.
Yeah.
Wait, did we get an open for it?
I don't know, Justin.
Justin's working on a little ditty there.
He was loafing over the weekend. So
sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance. Arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance. Intersection.
Yes. Well done, my man.
I didn't even know that he knew.
My Sharona?
My Sharona. I would think he would have no idea that that song even exists. Huh. All right, that's impressive. All right, we're going to play it again and do Serena Williams after this.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, speaking of Miss America, since that was on opposite the Bears game, this is, the first installment without the swimsuit competition.
Yeah. After 98 years, they decided to replace the swimsuit competition with a talent competition, and then they had a questionnaire section where the contestants would ask the other contestants questions. Mm. So they didn't have a star out there interviewing them.
Madeline Collins, Miss West Virginia, was asked a question on Friday night about the most serious issue facing the nation. She replied, Donald Trump is the biggest issue our country faces. Unfortunately, he has caused a lot of division in our country. Now, see, the problem with that is responses were limited to only 20 seconds, so she didn't get the additional detail. And I'm in complete agreement about eliminating the swimsuit competition, the evening gown competition. I want to eliminate it all. The entire Miss America pageant should be an extended interview with the contestants behind a screen so they remain unseen, because I don't want my judgment poisoned by their physical appearance. And it should be a complete intellectual exercise. So I want to really get into the weeds on, say, for example, Miss West Virginia's perspective on Donald Trump, on the other ladies' perspectives on climate change, on nuclear proliferation, on trade policy vis-a-vis China, energy independence. It should be an hour-long
Q&A.
Firing line type of discussion. So we really get a full understanding of their understanding of these important issues and make the judgment solely on that basis.
Well, maybe she listened to President Barack Obama before she got on stage and answered that question, because there's still the same level of hate. But just so you know, it's not a pageant anymore. It's called a competition. They made that very clear at the opening of the show.
I just turned it into a discussion, a debate.
Yeah, a debate.
Yeah.
And the winner was Miss New York, Nia Franklin. And her talent was singing opera. And you love the opera, right?
Yeah.
Well, is she good or is she bad?
So this is La Boheme.
I knew you'd know that.
No. I think La Boheme. We have it. She's making my brain hurt. I think La Boheme is part of the upcoming season for the Lyric.
Oh.
It'll be a lot better than that. I can guarantee you that. Again, Miss New York, Miss West Virginia, the whole raft of them. And by the way, not that I think it should be just Miss America.
Right.
I think I think Miss is discriminatory. So I'm sure Gretchen Carlson will want to take that under advisement.
She said that she feels really blessed right now. She wants to thank God because without him, I wouldn't be standing here. It took a lot of perseverance to get here. And I just want to thank my beautiful family for coming. My mom and my dad, who's a survivor of cancer, and I love him so much.
What I really would like to know from Ms. Franklin, though, is what do you think our policy should be towards Nicaragua with the meltdown that's occurring there and the potential refugee crisis? What? What should we do about
it? I know. I don't know what her line of questioning was when she was up there.
Miss West Virginia, yeah, I hear what you're saying about
Trump.
Well,
during the cut time.
Let me ask you a question. Your suggestions, give me two or three ideas about what we should do as it pertains to hyperinflation in Venezuela.
Well, hyperinflation in Venezuela, I am so glad you asked.
Yeah.
It is a problem. That's an example of a socialist country that has failed. And people are starving and even eating squirrels on the streets if they can even find them. And every day, 800 plus try to flee into Brazil just to survive.
Are you auditioning?
So that's a dictatorship that needs to be shut down.
Are you in the coaching business now?
That's the answer she should have offered.
It's not bad. It really doesn't address the hyperinflation, though.
No, I'm. Yeah.
This is why I want
I mean,
an
I have
hour.
Hypertension in my back. Is that what
that's,
we're talking
that's
about?
That's a hyper. Yes, it's not the hyper we're talking about, but. That's why I want the hour, so we can really plumb the depths. I'll tell you what. I'm going to give you a whiteboard.
Yeah.
Chart some supply and demand curves for me, and let's talk a little trade policy.
Just so you know, Franklin, her platform is going to be to promote healthy body image.
Healthy, I mean, again, I don't want to see the bodies. I just want to hear
That's
the answers.
The irony. We can't see their bodies. There's no evening gown competition. Or swimsuit competition, but that's her platform.
I just want to hear the answers, and I don't want to hear any more of Miss New York singing from La Boheme.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and
intersection.
Arrogance and ignorance. Arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance.
Intersection.
I'm going to be singing that all day.
Yes, Justin's good. So that's a good earworm song. So you can't,
good.
You can almost not go wrong adding lyrics to that.
Way to go.
Yeah, that's good. All right, so that's our new segment, Intersection of Sports and Politics. And we got it at the U.S. Open on the women's side, tennis. And again, you know my position on this. Serena Williams and Djokovic should be playing in the same tournament. One U.S. Open. One U.S. Open. I don't see gender. There's no reason to have women's and men's sports, including at the professional level. We'll see how Serena would do against your Roger Federer, against your Djokovic. Yeah. Okay. So she was up against this young woman, Osaka, who I guess Serena Williams is her hero, this Japanese Haitian tennis player. And she got into a bit of a row with the umpire, one Carlos Ramos.
Yeah, the cheer umpire.
Uh-huh.
And she called him a liar or a thief because he took a point away from her.
Right. So the issue is she was signaling with her coach.
Yeah.
And that's against the rules. And then when the penalties started being imposed, Serena Williams' rhetoric started escalating.
I didn't get coaching. You need to make an announcement that I didn't get coaching. I don't cheat. I didn't get coaching. How can you say that? You owe me an apology. cheated in my life.
Uh-oh.
I have a daughter, and I stand what's right for her, and I've never cheated. And you owe me an apology.
I'm a Bears fan.
And,
oh, Mama Bear just came out with the claws.
Yeah, you owe me an apology. I have a four-year-old daughter.
I've never cheated. Yeah, she's setting an example for her. So now she's taking it personally.
Couldn't be less interested. What does that have to do with anything? She continued demanding an apology, also threatening the umpire.
It's wrong. You attacking my character. Yes, you are. You owe me an apology. You will never, ever, ever be on another court of mine as long as you live.
Oh,
You don't decide that, honey, who your chair umpire is, okay?
And she persisted.
And are you going to give me my apology? You owe me an apology. Say it. Say you're sorry. Well, then don't talk to me. Don't talk to me.
I'm not listening to you.
I'm putting up my hand. Don't even look my way.
This is an impressive performance. And after her abusive conduct, after her abusive conduct earned her a game penalty, then she had this to say, demanding the referee step in.
Are you kidding me? Because I've said you're a thief. Because you stole a point from me. But I'm not a cheater. I told you to apologize to me.
All right, so she goes to the referee, and then it gets even more political.
Because it's sexist. It's like, you're doing this to me. Men do this all the time, but yet I'm being fined.
Yeah. If I could clarify something, was she playing against a woman?
Yes.
So I'm sorry. So how is it sexist?
And that's not right. This is not fair. Other men do things that are, I don't think they do much worse than that. This is not fair. There's a lot of men out here that have said a lot of things, and because they're men, that doesn't happen to them. Okay? No, I don't know the risk, because if I say a simple thing, a thief, because he stole a point from me, that does not make the thorough men out here. Do life parts because I'm a woman. Because I'm a woman, you're gonna take this away from me? That is not right. You know it, and I know you can't admit it, but I know you know it's not right. I know you can't change it, but I'm just saying that's not right. I get the rules. I get the rules, but I'm just saying it's not right.
The rules are sexist. 312-642-5600 Turnkey Depro answer line. 646-36-DA Turnkey Depro text line. Sexist? Case of sexism here?
Was it sexist, or was Serena Williams out of line? Yeah, for her in that position, she should have maintained more composure. I mean, she broke her racket. She got a $3,000 fine for that, $10,000 fine for the verbal abuse of the umpire chair, and $4,000 fine for being warned about coaching. Her coach was up in the stands, and she was communicating back and forth. But I think that she needs to dial it back, but she's not. This has inspired her, Dan, to make change in case there's other women in the future who have to go through this.
I can't sit here and say I wouldn't say he's a thief because I thought he took a game from me, but I've seen other men call other umpires several things, and I'm here fighting for women's rights and for women's equality and for all kinds of stuff. And for me to say thief and for him to take a game, it made me feel like it was a sexist remark. I mean, like, how he's never took a game from a man because they said thief. For me, it blows my mind. But I'm going to continue to fight for women and to fight for us to have equal. Like, Courtney should be able to take her shirt off without getting a fine. Yeah. Like, this is outrageous. You know? And I just feel like...
Yeah.
The fact that I have to go through this is just an example for the next person.
It's harrowing.
That has
Yeah,
and they want to express themselves and they want to be a strong woman. And they're going to be allowed to do that because of today.
Yeah.
Maybe it didn't work out for me, but it's going to work out for the next person.
Standing
O. Standing ovation.
I'll tell you, it's so inspired. Are you inspired by Serena Williams fighting for women's rights to excoriate umpires in professional tennis?
I think she was being treated like a man. I mean, John McEnroe, when he'd have his temper tantrums, he was fined, and he'd slam rackets, and he'd go to the chair umpire and start screaming at him.
By the way, I know the facts won't matter to this, you know, kind of all this identity politics nonsense that she's folding in because she knows it has an audience. This same umpire, Carlos Ramos, penalized Djokovic, the men's champion, number one player in the world on the men's side, for communicating with coaches recently. He also penalized Serena's sister Venus for it in 2016. So there's that. Martina Navratilova said, is another leftist, of course, said she agreed with Serena Williams' point, but she said it was the wrong forum and the wrong way in which to make that point. Billie Jean King.
Oh, yeah, she's rallying around her.
Yeah, she was more effusive in her praise of Serena. Yeah, here's the thing. It's not in dispute that signaling to your coach is, or your coach signaling to you is a violation of the rules.
There's rules in place for a reason. I mean, can you imagine it would be like this the whole time? You'd never watch the tennis match. I'd be coaching the whole time.
Well, Billie Jean King said it's a stupid rule. It should be eliminated. Okay, fine. I thought that being able to play zone defense in the NBA was a stupid rule, too, and it was ultimately eliminated. But while it was in force, if you played zone defense, you got a warning, and then you got the other team got a technical shot. So that was a rule that was in force. So if you want to change rules, change them. That, if you think they're stupid, or if the poobahs in women's tennis generally, think they're stupid. But this, like, the rule's stupid, so I can violate it. Then I can throw a temper tantrum. Then I can call the guy a thief. Then I can go into the histrionics of demanding an apology for an extended period of time and not suffer any consequences. Well, who the hell are you?
Is she so worried about her image and, you know, what her daughter's going to think? Smashing a racket on the court? I mean, yeah. So a little more decorum.
She did. No, she did this so that someday her daughter can grow up to
smash,
throw
rackets,
a temper tantrum on the court at an umpire. And I mean, this is a women's rights issue.
I'm surprised I didn't bring race into it yet. But also another point of contention is calling him a
Haitian
thief.
Japanese.
Is that a four-letter word? No, she called him a thief. And she's maintaining, like, I wasn't swearing at him because I called him a thief.
You will never be on another court of mine. You're the liar. I want an apology. Like, she's talking to a child.
Right. And, well, also, too, you don't decide who your umpire or your referee is in any game.
The point is that if that exchange would have happened between Steve Kerr and an NBA referee, teed up, thrown out of the game.
Yeah.
That's what would have happened.
Go to the locker room. Cool your heels.
I mean, or you know, Joe Maddon comes out of the dugout and he has this extended harangue against an umpire. Thrown out. Spare me. Honestly, spare me. She's behaved like a spoiled brat, just like men have behaved on the tennis court before. Of course, it's been a bygone era, and I'm sure present. I think I stopped watching men's tennis about
with Bjorn Borg.
I think. No, when Vitas Gerulaitis passed away, I just couldn't watch anymore. Women's rights, and I'm fighting for women's rights. You know what? I want you to go all the way to the other side, as I said. Let's make it completely equal, Serena, so we know. The only way we can know is if you have to face Federer and Nadal and Djokovic, and then we'll see how many trophies you take home. How about that? Eliminate gender-specific sports. Isn't that the enlightened thing to do?
You keep telling me it's coming our
century.
Way, and I hope it's not coming our way.
I hope it is. Jordan in Forest Park.
Hey, good morning. You know, I'm a big tennis fan, and I think what the problem with this whole thing was, for example, Chris Evert is the biggest Serena supporter of anybody out there, and when they showed the replay of what the coach did, Chris Evert immediately said, "That's coaching." He's telling her to move up to the net. And that's exactly what she did in the subsequent point.
Well, also, Jordan, Serena's coach said he was signaling to her.
Yeah, that's the point I'm trying to make, is the coach actually said, it was coaching. Now, I think if I'm Serena's coach, I might start to update my resume, because I think that she might just throw him out the door, because, you know, it just completely conflicted with what she said, because she said, oh, no, that was just a thumbs up gesture. So, I mean, she went ballistic and she just kept going at him for, you know, over and over. And she brought up the word cheat. Nobody brought up the word cheat.
Right.
The chair just said, that's coaching. She brought up the word cheat.
You're now calling me a thief and this and that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, she was concentrating on that. And then the other two things that happened, you know, she's out. But you know what? She was outplayed for the match. And it was very clear. She got steamrolled basically in the first set. I mean, that was, you know, Osaka was on fire. And Osaka was on fire for the most part in the second set. So I don't think she would have won anyway. Osaka was just able to stay with her.
Bud Collins, we got it, Jordan. Thanks for the call.
But even
we
after
only
she,
have so much tolerance for
even
women's
after she
call.
Smashed her racket, I mean, that cost her a point and a second code violation. So, you know, she wasn't winning.
John in Lake Geneva.
Hi, didn't that whole episode just reek of roid rage?
I don't know. Thanks for the call, John.
Don't they do drug testing in tennis?
I don't know.
You get what he said, though? Roid rage? I don't know if people heard him. Instead of road rage.
What?
He said roid rage. Like she's on roids.
Yeah? What would road rage have to do with this story?
I thought at first he said road rage, but it's roid rage. Now I get it. It's early.
I feel like Carlos Ramos. I'm just baffled.
Are you going to give me a violation?
If you demand an apology, if you tell me I'll never.
You're a thief. You're never going to be
never
on this
chair.
Court.
This microphone again. Greg and Schomburg.
What's really tragic about when you listen to her logic is it's identical to the logic that women are advancing, not only in sports, but in religion and everywhere else. And what's even more tragic about that is the succubent men that are buying into it. Our society is being bastardized by this singular root cause analysis of multiple dependent cause reality, which is being simplified irresponsibly by the women's movement.
Thanks for the call, Greg. And now for the typical, you know, race hustling, identity politics, pandering. Philip in Blue Island.
Hi, Philip.
You are hilarious. Amy.
I know, I'm a riot.
You are hilarious. Is Serena known for championships or for cheating? I mean, she has a stellar career of winning championships, but her cheating or anything of that nature is not a part of her.
Nobody said she was cheating. Nobody said she was cheating. She said she was cheating. She violated the rules. I mean, when somebody, when somebody travels, are they cheating? No, they violated the rules. They have to turn the ball over. That's all.
But he interpreted it wrong. She said it was a thumbs up, and she's not known as a liar. So, I mean,
she has
a long career.
Philip, the coach, her coach conceded that he was communicating to her. It is not in doubt.
Okay, if he's communicating to her, if he say thumbs up, great job.
Philip,
you know, just encouraging
Philip,
her.
I know everything with you is fact-free because you have to shoehorn everything into race and gender identity politics. There's nothing funny about it. It's your complete disinterest in facts that's actually laughable. And I'm not done because the coach said I was coaching her. Not I was signaling to her thumbs up, good job. I was coaching her. That's not in doubt. You're a hack. Later.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Former President Obama, so concerned about the future of the Republican Party. And I mean, I appreciate his concern. I think it's fantastic.
He's worried about all of us.
Very concerned about the future of the Republican Party. So concerned, he devoted an hour and 20 minute speech to it U of I on Friday.
Yeah, what was he there for at U of I?
The Paul Douglas Ethics and Government Award. The hilarity started there and just continued throughout his hour and 20-minute harangue. This is a guy, ethics and government, for a guy who was...
Was Emil Jones there handing him the award?
Yeah.
He was?
No.
Oh,
but okay. Emil Jones, Emil Jones squired him around Springfield like a designer dog. You know, like Paris Hilton would hold those little cockapoos or whatever they're called.
The little
called.
Purse dog that's what we call it.
That's number one. He mostly exists in the state Senate to vote present. Yeah. That was the extent of his presence. And U of I conferring him an Ethics and Government Award, that's an august institution, the same one that has a convicted domestic terrorist felon named James Kilgore as a resident scholar at the university. And of course, U of I system employed Bill Ayers until he retired to live off of Illinois taxpayers with a handsome pension. Another domestic terrorist. So, boy, this is high praise. We should take this award very seriously, as we should these institutions. Barack Obama, though, very concerned about what he's saying. Basically, what you have here is just insert Trump for the rhetoric he would use during State of the Union speeches and on the campaign trail against Republicans for his 8 years, more like 10 years if you count campaigning for president and then actually being president. Barack Obama talking about those who seek to divide us.
More often it's manufactured by the powerful and the privileged who want to keep us divided and keep us angry and keep us cynical because that helps them maintain the status quo and keep their power and keep their privilege. And you happen to be coming of age during one of those moments. It did not start with Donald Trump. He is a symptom, not the cause. He's just capitalizing on resentments that politicians have been fanning for years.
Resentments politicians have been fanning for years, like perhaps the speaker for the previous eight prior to Trump's election. Would President Obama be considered a politician who fanned the flames of resentment and division, the guy who referred to people clinging to their guns and religion? Is that fanning the flames of resentment and division? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-360A, turnkey.pro text line.
What he did when I was watching the hour and 20-minute long speech, I was shocked because I did not. This is a total break from protocol. I mean, growing up, I never heard President Carter, when he was, after he was out of office, he didn't get up there and slam the Republican Party. He didn't go on tour. Last night, President Obama in California, he's going, he's on tour because the midterms are less than 60 days away. But he made me feel bad, or he tried to make me feel bad, for being a Republican and for supporting President Trump.
What happened to the Republican Party? Its central organizing principle in foreign policy was the fight against communism, and now they're cozying up to the former head of the KGB. In a healthy democracy, there's some checks and balances on this kind of behavior, this kind of inconsistency.
Yeah.
But right now, there's nothing.
Yeah. No, right now, there's nothing.
I'm sorry, what was his hot mic moment with Medvedev, Putin's toady?
Yeah, wait until after the elections. I'll be able to help you out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Something of that.
And what is the substance of the record from the Trump administration in terms of sanctions and a tough posture towards Russia, not to mention taking out a bunch of Russians in Syria, literally? So cozying up to Putin, why? Because he uses flowery rhetoric from time to time. I don't like it, but that's cozying up. As you know, Obama is all about words, and he doesn't want you to judge his actions or the implications. And for me, with respect to Trump, as difficult as it is sometimes, I try to kind of get past the rhetoric and just look at behavior. I mean, ultimately, that's all I care about anyway. And isn't that really what we should care about? Somebody's behavior? Politicians bloviate on all kinds of topics and all kinds of ways to position themselves all the time. what matters is what you actually do. Are you acting in furtherance of what you said you would do, or are you acting a contravention of it? Are you being consistent or are you being inconsistent? Are you advancing my interests and the interests of a free society, or are you inhibiting or negatively impacting those interests? But for Obama, it's all about words and projection of who he is onto other people.
Well, the thing is, too, I knew that the DNC or the Democratic Party would hit back against Trump and the Republicans because they're trying to take over the House. But I didn't think it would be President Obama who would be delivering the message. I thought it would be somebody else from the Democratic Party.
Do you understand what this speech was? I mean, do you understand it? This speech had two purposes. And they have nothing to do with Trump. If Obama is speaking, it is about a single person, Barack Obama. Barack Obama is trying to pick from the smoldering ruins of his administration and the successes of this one, talking about how, you know, the recovery started.
Okay, that's all him, yeah.
So he's trying to pick from the smoldering ruins of his administration's legacy and the successes of this one to give leftist historians something to hang their hat on so they can remember him how Obama remembers himself in the category of Lincoln. That's number one. And the second purpose of this speech was a make good with his party. Remember, Barack Obama turned the Democrat Party into a super minority party nationally. Now that there is something perhaps approaching a wave, certainly energy behind this anti-Trump movement and the opportunity for significant midterm pickups and perhaps control of the House, he wants to get in on that action so that that his legacy of turning his party into a super minority party can be erased, at least partly. This is about his interests in terms of his position in history and fodder he can give leftist historians to utilize for the continued myth-making, and his standing in the party so that he's not relegated to New England, Illinois, and California, and he can go in red states again. And that's really what this is, to my estimation. This has nothing to do with Trump. Trump is just a convenient whipping boy to serve Obama's political interests.
But I couldn't believe how cocky he was when he talked about the economy. Oh, yeah.
So when you hear how great the economy is doing right now, let's just remember when this recovery started.
Yeah, he took credit. But President Trump, who was campaigning for congressional members in Fargo, North Dakota, he was quick-witted and fought back fairly quick.
I'm sorry, I watched it, but I fell asleep. I found he's very good for sleeping. I think he was trying to take some credit. He was trying to take credit for this incredible thing that's happening to our country. If the Democrats could, and I have to say this to President Obama, and it wasn't him, but would have been the same thing. If the Democrats got in with their agenda in November of almost 2 years ago, instead of having 4.2 up, I believe, honestly, you'd have 4.2 down.
Yeah, and here's the other thing. On the matter of executive overreach, and so we hear a lot about Trump's authoritarian impulses and his executive overreaches. Let's just remember what the record is. I know facts don't matter to the Obama acolytes and to those trained SEALs in the audience at U of I. But the Obama administration lost time and again with executive overreaches and federal government overreaches more generally. 44 unanimous losses during his term, including with being unable to garner support from his own nominees, Sotomayor and Kagan, from the range of topics, criminal procedure, religious liberty, property rights, immigration, securities regulation, tax law, separation of powers, the Cato Institute, Ilya Shapiro at Cato Institute had a nice rundown of it back just a couple of years ago. Loss after loss before the high court, overreaches with a predatory federal government and a imperious executive branch with President Obama there. So it's all the words, the high-minded rhetoric, anodyne as it is, and don't pay attention to anything I do. That's the flim-flammery of Obama, and a lot of people bought it and still do. Bruce in Bloomingdale.
102 times he said the word I in a speech that lasted 10 minutes. It tells you everything you need to know about the infestation of narcissistic personality disorder that the man has.
Thanks for the call, Bruce. Lee in Hammond.
Yeah, hi, guys. I hope Obama keeps on the stump and keeps making speeches. You know, we need to get the swing voters energized for November. If we lose this thing, it'll be because we can't get the vote out. And every time he opens his mouth, all he does is remind us what 8 years of Obama was really like.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Lee. And you're right about getting the vote out. I mean, it is worth noting, so far in the primary season of recent special elections, turnout among Democrats is up 78% compared to 14. Republican turnout's also increased, but only by 23%. So, you know, this is what people mean when they say intensity matters, enthusiasm matters. Chip in St. Charles.
You know, Barack Obama said that he wanted to bring sanity back to politics, and I was wondering how he's going to do that when he doesn't even know what bathroom to use.
Thanks for the call, Chip. And here's the other thing. He, you know, mentioned, you know, conspiracy theories that GOP embraced, like his birth certificate.
Yeah, he brought that up again. Trump doesn't even stop Nazi enthusiasts.
But conspiracy theories the GOP embraces, birth certificate, and like those surrounding Benghazi.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, what was that about?
Chris Paranto, who was a CIA security contractor, and he's a U.S. Army Ranger, he was in Benghazi when Islamic extremists overran that embassy and murdered Ambassador Stevens and the others. He tweeted a response to Barack Obama about Benghazi conspiracy theories. Quote, Benghazi is a conspiracy, Barack Obama? How about we do this? Let's put your cowardly ass on top of a roof with six of your buddies and shoot RPGs and AK-47s at you while terrorists lob 81-millimeter mortars killing two of your buddies, all while waiting for U.S. support that you never sent. Hashtag scum.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, you remember Kirk Heinrich?
Yeah, he played for the Bulls.
Yeah, Kansas star, had a good career in the NBA. He retired last year. He may have to start playing again after the hammering he took trying to get out from underneath his home in Bannockburn. He moved his family to Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Oh, that town is beautiful.
Yeah, he's
Everyone should check it out.
Sioux City, Iowa. But yeah, Sioux Falls, that's growing too. I'm sure more and more Chicagoans. So this Bannockburn estate.
Mm-hmm. Give me the details.
Eight and a third baths, six-car garage, resort-like swimming pool.
A third
pool.
Of a bath?
fully stocked fishing pond on 6 acres.
Nice.
He bought the home in 2007 for $5.35 million, real dollars. He sold it on August 30th.
Oh, my gosh. For how much?
Guess.
$5 million?
You haven't been paying attention to our property tax.
No, if you have a stocked pond in your backyard, 8.5 bath, sounds like a beautiful place. Bannockburn's gorgeous.
It would be a beautiful place if it was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, but it's in Bannockburn, Illinois, in Lake County. $5.35 million real dollars, June of 2007, sold it August 30th for $2.75. During the time owned that home, a decade, he paid $750,000 in property taxes. So he lost more than $3 million on his property in Bannockburn. Now, Kirk Heinrich can weather it, of course.
Yeah, big contracts. No, but still, that's rape. I mean, that is, well, boy, that's a kind of aggressive for a Monday morning. I mean,
financial.
Financial, that's what I meant.
I mean, this is the point. I don't know how to drive this into people's skulls. And I don't know how many more people we need to enlist as ambassadors for this. There is no escape. I don't care if you're Kirk Heinrich worth tens of millions of dollars or you're a workaday Joe trying to, you know, get out from underneath a home that's, you know, median price, couple hundred grand, 250 grand. Or you're somebody who's trying to enter the home ownership ranks so you can build wealth and drop roots. You can't make an investment in property in this state make sense, period, full stop, until and unless we change the property tax system. It is confiscatory. It is a government taking. And here's the bottom line for November 6th and beyond. You either start to force the people in charge out, or they will force you out. That will happen.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Tickets for Freedom Summit Chicago are on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You ready for the bullet tax in Chicago? Remember, that's one of Tony Preckwinkle's great ideas at the county. Tax bullets, tax ammo. That's a way to increase the peace on the streets. I'll tell you what's not a way. Install one of your proteges, Kim Fox, in the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. That's a catastrophe. Hey. All you have to do is ask anybody who works there. In addition to the results that we see with respect to prosecutions and sentencing. But okay. Over the weekend, SCIU, the Purple People Beaters.
Oh, these, yeah. How are those guys doing?
One of the unions that recruited Tony Preckwinkle into the race for mayor after Tiny Dancer's announcement last week. They commissioned a survey by Public Policy. So Public Policy Polling. So this is like home cooking numbers. Okay. And they wouldn't release this if they didn't think that this was something to wave around for their girl. Well, they find that Preckwinkle leads the field, the prospective field, with 25% of the vote. Undecided is 19%. Vallis is third at 16%. McCarthy is fourth at 13%. Willie Wilson fifth with 10%. Now, it is important to note several candidates that may get in were not included in the poll. El Gallito, Chewy, oh, Bill Daley. Bill Daley, I understand, is going to get in. Jerry Joyce, Jerry Joyce Jr. But I mean, 25 to 19 to 16 to 13, that's not a prohibitive favorite. I'm a little surprised that it's that close, it's that bunched up, it's that competitive. I thought Preckwinkle would be a bigger favorite than she actually is. If I was SEIU, I would have never released this. What this tells me is that Preckwinkle is absolutely vulnerable. She's not the clear and away front runner. She's not necessarily the next mayor whatsoever, if that's where she stands now.
Well, people don't find courage and leadership in somebody who decided after the incumbent dropped out then to run for mayor of Chicago. People don't respect that. And I have to tell you, she's not doing it. She's not banging it up there. She's not knocking it down over there as Cook County Board President. People still have resentment about the sugar tax, and she's just not a leader.
Sugar tax, bullet tax.
Bullet tax, what else?
Property tax.
Property, oh yeah.
Also, after she campaigned against Todd Stroger on the sales tax increase, she reinstituted it.
Right. Remember that? The penny tax that took it away and then brought it in again. She lied to the people of Cook County. So why would we, why would anybody back her?
Maybe there's also, she's not a particularly attractive candidate. She's not a particularly warm candidate. I mean, she doesn't have, you know, overwhelming charisma.
No.
So it's not like there's a lot of cult of personality. There's a cult of personality around the public sector unions and distributing jobs and pension benefits that you can't finance. I get that. But that's not quite the same thing. And I think, you know, don't forget, Chicago is more culturally conservative than certainly New York or L.A. So the idea of going full de Blasio in this city, full Sandinista, I think is going to be met with some resistance. There's a lot of people who understand who Tony Preckwinkle is. She didn't just show up on the scene. She's been a wholly owned subsidiary of the public sector unions for the two decades. She sat on the city council as an alderman from Hyde Park, and now her two terms as Cook County Board President that are rather unremarkable, as are the terms of every Chicago Democrat who's been in office for any extended period of time in our lifetimes. So I think, look, in terms of the potential field, as well as the field that actually exists at this point, it will probably increase this week, starting with Preckwinkle. I got to say, I mean, if you look at it, I mean, the only sane person, the only person that I think actually would represent something approaching system change with all of the civic institutions in Chicago that are crumbling, none of which is financeable in its current form, is Vallis.
I agree 100%.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
And what I want to know, if she makes her big announcement today, if I'm a reporter sitting in the front row, this is what I'm asking her. Why now? Why did you have to wait for Rahm Emanuel to drop out in order to come forward? What does he have on you that if you decided to run while he was still running, what does he have on you? I want to know. Because he had something on her. You know he did, because if she really wanted to run, she would have been out there 6 months ago, like everybody else.
Well, one of the things you also have to remember is that Preckwinkle's never really had a race.
Oh, cool. Well,
I mean, taking on Todd Schroeder in a primary.
Ooh, she beat Urkel. Woo.
Right. So she's
with her and her husband that night. They let me go behind the scenes and go into their hotel room, and I got to meet Zeus.
Zeus? Yeah. Zeus Preckwinkle.
Yeah.
Sorry that didn't work out.
No, it didn't work out.
I mean, she's never really had a race. And my sense is that she thinks this is going to be a coronation, that she thinks she'll overwhelm the field. She has the muscle of the public sector unions. She'll probably get the socialist Latino crowd like Chuy and El Gallito. I don't know that they make the race. So she probably figures that this coalition will get stitched together by the public sector unions for her benefit. And she could just don her Statue of Liberty garb and walk in parades, and that'll be sufficient. I think she didn't want to take on Rahm 4 years ago when she was in a much stronger position. And she doesn't want to take on Rahm now.
Why?
Because it's work. Because Rahm is cutthroat. Because whatever they have and whatever they can produce, it will be intense, and there's a lot of money behind it. The other candidates right now, that could change now that the race has opened up a bit, don't have the resources to carpet bomb her like Rahm could have.
And Rahm has personal information on her, well, on her home life that I think he would use against her.
Well, whatever. The point is you're facing a water cannon. And right now, with respect to the other candidates, you're facing a squirt gun. And she sees this as path of least resistance. And that's what she cares about, path of least resistance. And obviously, mayor, he has a lot more standing and a consequence than is Cook County Board President.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I heard, too, that Tony Preckwinkle was handpicked by Mike Madigan so that he could control the school system. And he could run Chicago, too. Because he already runs the governor's office. Yeah. I mean, our governor even admitted, I don't have the power here. Mike Madigan does.
Yeah,
and that he wants Tony Preckwinkle convinced SEIU to get her to run because then he'll be the puppet
whichever
master.
Democrat operative you're talking to doesn't know what they're talking about. So you should stop talking
about
to
Bill
that
Daly, right? I mean, don't you think he's going to jump into the race?
Well, yeah, but that wasn't his prediction. Well,
that was one of the...
What was his other prediction?
Okay, fine. He was wrong. The other prediction was that Mayor Emanuel would run for president or possibly be the VP on the Biden ticket.
Yeah, and we have a bet on that.
Right. How much did we bet? My
100 grand or something?
My used minivan out there?
This related piece in the New York Times from Natalie Moore. She's a reporter over at BEZ. Talking about what this election could be about. Chicago's one of the most segregated cities in the United States. Yeah. It's a fact that is treated by too many here as a footnote or a quirky characteristic. segregation gets ignored because it's accepted, but segregation is intentional, and dismantling it must be too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Natalie, Miss Moore, who's been in charge of Chicago for 100 years?
I know. Wake up.
If it's been intentional, then it's been intentional at whose hands? Conservative Republicans? You've got a lot of long-serving black elected officials, including Preckwinkle. What have they done to break down the walls of segregation? What has CTU done to live up to the promise of Brown v. Board of Education, Miss Moore? I love the paeans to integration and extended opportunity where there isn't any, and extended safety where public safety is limited. And no accountability, no assignment of responsibility to who's been in charge. You want to know why Chicago is the most segregated city in the country? You want to know why Chicago is effectively the murder capital of the country for a major city? Twice the murder rate of LA and New York combined. You want to know why?
Why?
Because people don't hold people in charge accountable. That's why. Natalie, they talk about these issues. They just continue to talk about them and talk about them and talk about them. But the people in charge are never responsible. It's Trump's fault, right? Mike on the north side.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. First off, if it's a segregated city, it's segregated economically. So the people at the bottom don't have the mobility. The people on welfare don't have the mobility. Whose fault is that? Second of all, if you think Tony Preckwinkle is a bad county board president, she's somewhat limited in her tax raising schemes as county board president. If she becomes mayor with home rule powers, it's, you know, Katie bar the door, turn the lights out, we're Detroit.
Thanks for the call, Mike.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, speaking of campaigns, as we're a couple of months out from the big day, this is a smart move or an act of desperation? Bruce Rauner, yeah, the former governor, still campaigning, nobody's told him. He's got his wife Diana now featured in his most recent ad because, you know, going to make that appeal to suburban women who also want to be forced to pay for other people's abortions, apparently. Diana Rauner making the case.
I'm Diana Rauner. Bruce ran for governor to try to save our state. It hasn't been easy, but nothing important ever is. Bruce took on the big problems. Education funding reform, Medicaid reform, criminal justice reform. He stopped the insanity and delivered. But 40 years of mismanagement can't be turned around in 4 years. This election is a choice. Do we keep moving towards reform or go back to the status quo that got us into this mess?
Hilarious.
When you bring out the wife, could be a problem. We're 60 days out.
Cliches.
He took on the big problems for you, the people, because he cares. I'm Diana Rauner.
That wasn't the value proposition either. I mean, it's very much recasting things the way that the left would, because he's been an abject failure. So what he promised, what the value prop was, hey, if I don't get things on the road to recovery after one term, I'm not running again.
Right.
Because I don't need this, because I'm not a politician. Boy, sure sounds like he's a politician. And I know that Diana Rauner is a politician. And they're professional liars. And there is no credibility on any of those items that she refers to generically, because she can't refer to them specifically, because there is no record of accomplishment. There's a record of exacerbating all the problems and surrendering to cultural Marxists at every turn. That's the record. That's why Bruce Rauner is an anchor around the neck of every Republican in this state. And just remember, we'll see what comes to pass, but I've been saying it since like last year this time, after he surrendered on taxes and everything else, that you had a choice, or you, I predicted you would have a choice. You did have a choice. Republican Party did. The state did. And you chose to stick with the status quo that Diana Ronner is talking about. There are consequences to that. And they're going to be visited upon us on November 6th.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Lindsey Graham had an interesting theory on the New York Times op-ed connecting it to the Mueller investigation. Listen to the senator.
This op-ed piece about the personality of the president, suggesting that he's unhinged and he is incapable of being a good president without being minded, tells me a lot about the Mueller investigation. This, to me, is a signal that if there's nothing there with Russia in terms of the president working with the Russians during his campaign, the next line of attack is the man is unfit for office. He's crazy.
Now we're back to the 25th Amendment case. And, of course, you have the Bob Woodward book to help buoy that case, at least in D.C. press corps circles. Interesting theory from Graham. Of course, now that runs counter to that big scalp that Mueller got on Friday with George Papadopoulos getting that 14-day prison sentence for lying to the FBI. Wow.
Whoa, that's a big one.
Yeah, they knocked me over with a feather. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney in Manhattan, contributing editor at National Review, now nationalreview.com. He's written on both of the topics, the Mueller investigation as well as the op-ed. Andy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Dan, Amy, I stayed up and watched Aaron Rodgers last night, so my sympathies to you folks.
Yeah, he's the X Factor. Yeah,
he was never really out, was he?
Yeah, it's Cinderella story from out of nowhere. Yeah, exactly.
There was collusion, yeah, the medical test.
What do you make of Lindsey Graham's supposition that there's nothing there with Russia despite the Papadopoulos plea and sentence, and so it's all going to be 25th Amendment unfit for office rhetoric from Democrats?
Well, I about 75% agree with him, and he is making a point I try to make in my weekend column about questioning Mr. Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, about exactly what crime it is that Trump is alleged to have committed or is under investigation for. Since that's supposed to be the trigger of any investigation, there's supposed to be a crime first, and then you get a prosecutor. The reason I say I only three-quarters agree with Senator Graham, or at least what's been reported about it, is I don't think that this goes to the 25th Amendment. I think the departure from the way that investigations are normally done goes to impeachment. And what I mean by that is, I expect that because Mueller has not had to investigate based on a crime, that is that the boundaries of his investigation have not been what the normal boundaries are, what the regulations require, which is the factual basis to believe a crime was committed. I believe what he will file is a report that doesn't find any prosecutable crimes, but has a lot of information in it that's unflattering of the president, you know, erratic judgment, bringing people of questionable character and Russia connections into his campaign, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the point of that will be twofold. One will be to defend the FBI and the Justice Department for having had a rational basis to investigate, even if there was no probable cause of a crime. And secondly, I think, you know, he can put that all in a report. And then once the Democrats win the midterms, if they do, the Congress does not need a crime, a prosecutable crime, in order to file articles of impeachment. So if there's enough unflattering information that they can inflate into high crimes and misdemeanors, they'll use it for that purpose.
Yeah, but what you're saying, what you're suggesting is just that he would write up a report that sounds like the Woodward book.
Well, the point, Dan, is that there's no he's not supposed to be able to do that. My point in the column over the weekend is
right.
He is not counsel for a congressional impeachment committee. He's a federal prosecutor, which means his only job is to decide whether there's sufficient evidence to proceed on criminal offenses or to decline criminal offenses. That's what the regulations say. And my point is, because Rosenstein has not limited him to criminal offenses, he's at liberty, it seems, to write a report on exactly that, a kind of a here's my impression of the president's fitness for office book. And in the meantime, the president's fitness for office is a very important issue, but it's an issue for the public and the Congress. It's not an issue for a federal prosecutor.
So what does it mean now that the former Trump advisor George Papadopoulos has been sentenced to 14 days behind bars?
Seems to me that Mrs. Clinton said that she didn't know what C meant in classified documents. That ought to be worth at least 15 days.
I mean, is it going to affect the investigation?
No, I mean, look, it goes to show. We were told, Amy, months ago that this was the big nugget that launched the investigation to end all investigations, right? The Papadopoulos angle. And what this demonstrates, it really just underscores what we already knew, which was this guy was never, ever charged with anything remotely connected to a conspiracy crime having to do with cyber espionage with Russia. And if you look at the lie that he was prosecuted for, it's chump change. I mean, basically, he lied about the timing of a conversation because in the eyes of Mueller, the fact that he had the conversation with this Maltese academic, Mifsud, after he was in the Trump campaign versus just before he was in the Trump campaign, and there was a little gray area about when exactly he joined the Trump campaign, but that was a material fact, and the fact that he was misleading about it was the crime of the century. Well, now we see the crime of the century is worth 2 weeks.
Yeah. I want to go back to your piece over the weekend, Mr. Rosenstein, where what is the crime? And you write, what's the legal basis for his special counsel investigation? We have a right to know. It is intolerable that after more than 2 years of digging, we still do not have an answer to that simple question. So if you were part of President Trump's legal team, would you be advising him to stop tweeting about Jeff Sessions and whistle Rosenstein in for an answer to that question and make that answer public or demand publicly that he answer that question if he resists?
I would have stopped long ago tweeting about Sessions. And by the way, I think there's a lot more going on at the Justice Department than people seem to think. So, the fact that you're not hearing about a lot of investigative activity, folks, that means that the Justice Department is functioning the way it's supposed to, which is that you don't hear anything until they're ready to charge somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But putting that aside, the president's kind of ridiculous jihad against his attorney general, I do think that the public deserves an answer after 2 years of the pressing question of why do we have this investigation, namely, what is the crime? And I expect that the reason we don't get that answer is twofold. Number one, there is no crime. They've been using the pretext of the Russia counterintelligence investigation, that is the investigation of Russia's interference in the election, which nobody disputes that they need to do, as a cover to investigate Trump criminally, even though there's no crime. So I think they don't want to come out and say that. Secondly, if you remember, on August 2nd, 2017, Rosenstein amplified Mueller's jurisdiction in this secret memorandum, which we haven't been allowed to see. If I were Trump, I'd force him to come clean on that one. But I suspect that what happened is he relied heavily on the Steele dossier in expanding or explaining what Mueller's jurisdiction is.
Right.
Memo that he issued was right around the same time as he signed off on the FISA warrant that we know relied on the Steele dossier.
But both of those prongs that you believe explains why we don't have an answer to that question redound to the president's benefit. So why isn't he and his legal team pressing on that?
I have a feeling they may be. I think that, timing in life is everything. What we keep hearing is that They may roll out some information about the Page FISA warrant this week.
Yeah, right.
I have a feeling that maybe there's actually a strategy here, and that as long as politics is being played against the president, that he's decided to wait until after Labor Day when everybody's, you know, paying more attention again to start rolling this stuff out. At least I assume that's what's going on here. You know, I know that people think the president is wild and crazy, and I think that myself a lot of the time, but the people around him are not. I mean, he's got very, very good lawyers, and I would not be surprised if there's a more sophisticated public strategy than people think here.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was your reaction when you heard, you know, I think it was on Friday that President Trump said he wanted the Sessions and the Department of Justice to investigate who the leaker is to the New York Times, yeah, who wrote the op-ed?
Yeah, I thought that was really reprehensible. I think, you know, I understand that the president doesn't like the op-ed, and if the person who wrote it is discovered, I think I'd be the first person to support him firing that person and kicking him out of the White House, you know, forthwith. But let's not continue to do what the left does and pretend that every single bad thing that happens is a crime. You know, I tweeted over the weekend when I saw some of this stuff. I happen to be one of the handful of people in this country who's actually tried a seditious conspiracy case. And to say that this op-ed is sedition or treason is lunatic stuff. I mean, it just sounds crazy. The president is not the country. You know, you can't have treason without somebody lending aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States, not the political enemies of Donald Trump. Sedition is conspiracy to use force against the United States to overthrow the system. Do you know how crazy it is, how crazy it sounds when people talk about an op-ed? I mean, really, an op-ed,
yeah,
as sedition or treason? That's loony talk.
I totally agree. And by the way, the actual case of sedition you tried, you're referring to the first World Trade Center bombing, yeah?
I am, and you may be about to remind me that tomorrow is what the 17th anniversary of the 9/11 attack, and it's 25 years since the World Trade Center was bombed.
Yeah.
So we're still talking about the same things.
He is Andy McCarthy, former Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney in Manhattan, prosecutor of the first World Trade Center bombers, as we were just discussing. Also contributing editor at National Review, nationalreview.com. Check out his weekend piece, Mr. Rosenstein, What is the Crime? Andy, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
You guys have a great week.
You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, a couple of notes on the midterms. Beckett Adams has a good piece on socialist poster girl for the Democrat socialists, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
She's back in the bar business?
She's a classic limousine liberal, literally. She, when she was running for that primary, we're running to be the nominee for that congressional seat, she had tweeted, yellow cab drivers are in financial ruin due to the unregulated expansion of Uber. So she's a big fan of what Sandinista and de Blasio is doing to curtail Uber and Lyft and ride-sharing companies in New York. Mm-hmm. What was a living wage job now pays under minimum. We need to call Uber drivers what they are, employees, not contractors. Federal jobs guarantee, prep for automation. But Beckett Adams over the Washington Examiner did a little comparing of Ocasio-Cortez's behavior to her rhetoric. Her campaign, has spent an estimated $4,000 on 160 Uber rides and $2,500 on more than 90 rides with another ride-sharing service called Juno, according to the FEC data that she provided, as she's required to disclose. So there's one standard for political grandstanding and another when it comes to utilizing services that get you to places quickly and affordably. It's just worth noting the hypocrisy of the left on these issues that they use to whip up the energy of largely ill-informed. And I say again, as I mentioned earlier, so far this primary and special election season, Democrat turnout is up 78% as compared to the 14 midterms. Republicans only up 23%. So enthusiasm matters. There's a good piece in Roll Call by Nathan Gonzalez about the five states that will decide the House majority and what the Democrats are targeting from each of those five states in terms of pickups. They're looking for one in Minnesota and five in California and two in New York and two in a state called Illinois.
Yeah, that's what. Well, how is Congressman Peter Roskam doing?
Dead heat.
Do you think it would help if President Trump came to Illinois and had a campaign rally in DuPage County for him?
Probably not. But Mike Boston, Southern Illinois, could probably use another visit to his neck of the woods. Mike Boss down there is in a dead heat. Roskam's in a dead heat. The last survey I saw on Randy Holtgren up here in the collar counties, dead heat. Rodney Davis down Central Illinois way, also in a competitive race. So, there's some real issues here, some real threats for a seat. I mean, Roskam's seat, you're talking about the seat that Henry Hyde held.
Right.
You're talking about seats in the suburbs that have been Republican as long as I've been alive, that are in play, that were two-thirds Republican districts a couple cycles ago, and now are statistical dead heats all over Northwest suburban Cook and the collar counties. It's a real thing. And people, Republicans,
need to get out and vote.
They
and have to. It's not a, you have to. It's a must.
Well, they need to do more than that. And it's really about conversations, right? I mean, you have to be active and you have to sort of control your circle of influence or try to influence your circle of influence. It's not enough to just vote quietly. I know people are afraid of ridicule and I know people are afraid of being ostracized, but are you more afraid of that than you are about your future in this state, in this country? And that for your progeny? I mean, just, these are the things that are at stake in big elections where you have the threat of real upheaval, a.k.a. an impeachment proceeding, in addition to ever trying to recapture something resembling what Illinois once was. So inform people. Share stories.
Talk to people, please.
See, this is how it works. It's not an epiphany. It's not somebody else's job. People you have a trust relationship with are interested in what you have to say more so than me, more so than what I have to say, some guy they don't know on the radio. Inform them of what's happening to you. Ask them to share their story. People get informed. They change their understanding. They change their behavior on election day. It changes the results. It's a continuum. So there's center-right families throughout suburban Cook and the collars that better start helping people get on that continuum unless you want to go full de Blasio, not just in Chicago, but statewide.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2, right before Joe Walsh at 5, on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and the evidence continues to mount. A letter confirms Vatican officials knew of McCarrick allegations against Cardinal McCarrick that were made in 2000. Father Boniface Ramsey, pastor of St. Joseph's Church in York, St. Joseph's Church Yorkville in New York City, told the Catholic News Service that on September 7th, that he received a letter dated October 11th, 2006, from a Vatican official asking for information regarding a priest in the Archdiocese of New York who studied at Immaculate Conception Seminary, who was being vetted for a post at a Vatican office. Vatican official wrote to Father Ramsey, "I ask with particular reference to serious matters involving some of the students of the seminary in question, which in November 2000 you were good enough to bring confidentially to the attention of the Apostolic Nuncio in the United States, the late Archbishop Gabriel Montalvo." So just evidence that the Vatican had communicated with a priest stateside about allegations against McCarrick that dated back to 2000, this letter that Father Ramsey released for scrutiny, dated October 11, 2006. And yet Pope Francis called for silence and prayer in the wake of these allegations against McCarrick and the Vatican last week. And then there's this locally. One of the top flacks for Pope Francis has been Cardinal Supich here.
Yeah.
Vincent McCaffrey. Vincent McCaffrey is a priest who in Chicago area, sentenced to 20 years in federal prison back in 2003 for possession and receipt of child pornography. Though he never was charged with abusing kids, McCaffrey admitted during the court case that he had molested so many he couldn't remember the exact number.
Sick.
Another priest at the time, Reverend Raymond Godert, wrote to then Cardinal Bernardine. One of the key parishioners received an anonymous phone call which made reference by name to Vince, this priest, and alleged misconduct on his part with young boys. We all agreed the best thing would be for Vince to move.
Oh, instead of throwing Vince in jail or calling the police?
We don't know if the anonymous caller will strike again. Godert was promoted to auxiliary bishop in 91, retired in 2003. He acknowledged in 2007, in response to questions from lawyers deposing him, that he knew 25 priests had broken the law over the years by molesting children, but he had never alerted police. A decade later, nothing changes. It just is the case here with McCarrick and the Vatican. A decade later, Godert remains in good standing as a bishop, and he also is living in the Cardinal's mansion on Chicago's Gold Coast.
Right now?
Cardinal Supich's house guest, according to the Chicago Sun-Times.
His Cato Kalin?
Well,
house guest?
Sort of, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how are we to take Cardinal Supich's calls for the church to deal with sexual misconduct and cover-ups when he has somebody who was a cover-upper living in the mansion in the Gold Coast? For more on both of these topics, we're pleased to be joined by Mary Hassan. She's a Katie O'Byrne Fellow in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, also the director of the Catholic Women's Forum. She was one of the signatories on that letter that we read last week, signed by dozens and dozens of prominent Catholic women calling on Pope Francis to answer some simple, straightforward questions, that silence wasn't enough. And if you remember the line that I liked the most, it was the line in that letter about these women being as much of the church as the bishops and the cardinals and the hierarchy. Mary Rice Hassan, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Well, why don't we start locally for us with Cardinal Supich and his house guest. How do you react to that?
Well, I don't know the immediate circumstances. I understand the Cardinal's mansion is in disrepair, so I'm not quite sure whether that's a lavish place for him to be or not. But really what this points to is what you mentioned earlier when you were speaking, is that there is just a culture of cover-up that has existed for decades. And I think when you referenced earlier the letter that or the confirmation that has come out that, yes, indeed, the Vatican knew back in 2000 that then-Cardinal McCarrick was engaged in serious misconduct with seminarians. That means that was 18 years before lay people got any wind of that. And the cardinal was being promoted as sort of the face and the distinguished, persona in the American church here. So there's a culture that's longstanding of just tolerating not just child abuse, which is horrible in itself, but a more generalized climate of sexual misconduct where it's just looked the other way and as if lay people have no stake in knowing about that and having priests living lives of integrity and bishops living lives of integrity.
I'm confused about the McCarrick because the Catholic Church settled with two of his alleged victims, one for, I believe, $80,000, another one for $100,000. These were seminary students who he molested or harassed. When did that officially come out?
That was not publicized until this year.
Okay.
So even though those settlements were, I believe, over a decade ago, those did not come out into the public discussion. And then Cardinal McCarrick was still being promoted, and in particular under Pope Francis, he was sort of revitalized, if you will, and given responsibility specifically.
What is
to be the face of the church?
Well, right, and so you know, because it wasn't publicized, and I think this is the point you're getting to, doesn't mean that people internally didn't know. Particularly as you say, he is being promoted and elevated and scrutinized for promotion per this letter from Father Ramsey in at St. Joseph's in New York City, and so. Where do you sense that the internal pressure is right now for Francis to do something other than offer silence and prayer?
Well, I know that the American bishops, led by Cardinal DiNardo, are doing a terrific job of just insisting that the Vatican address this, that they've asked for a visitation, they've asked for an investigation. To the extent they're not getting a reply, that responsibility falls on those who are surrounding Pope Francis and Pope Francis himself. And I think that's the frustrating thing here. That's what I'm hearing from women, this hurt and betrayal and just this sense of deep frustration and anger that the church, the institutional church, does not appear to be taking this seriously, or at least does not feel like there needs to be an accountability and a response to lay people when it's our children who were, you know, abused, or our sons who were in the seminary who were exploited and manipulated by people like, you know, McCarrick. So there's just this willingness of people who were higher up to keep the laity in the dark and to just cover for each other. And that really, I think, is the source of the anger.
Do you think Pope Francis should be forced to resign or step down from all this?
No, I would not go that far. I'm not even going to get into that question. I think that the immediate question is, or the thing on the table is this. We have a hurting church, and you can't begin to heal from a wound until you clean it out. Yep. You expose it to the light, you clean it out, and then you can apply whatever remedies you need and begin to heal. So we can't jump to the remedies without cleaning things out and knowing exactly what the problem is, because that's what got us, you know, in this country, that's what got us into trouble back in 2002. Really good guidelines were put in place for reporting of child abuse by priests, and the number of priest predators has dropped dramatically. But there was nothing put in place for bishops who were predators. There was no reporting mechanism, no accountability mechanism, nor was there anything for just this generalized climate of priestly misconduct or bishop misconduct and the willingness to tolerate and cover that up. So if you don't acknowledge problems, you can't fix them. And that's why we're in this spot right now.
And it seems to me that the hierarchy, at least aspects of the hierarchy, are completely indifferent to the damage it's doing to the church, the numbers of people that are leaving the church because they don't distinguish between the faith and the church. They're so disgusted by the church. I mean, incidents like what happened the other weekend where Cardinal Wuerl is shamed publicly during his homily in D.C. And again, it's just they're just kind of playing damage control like a politician and hoping they can wait this out. And I wonder what other pressure can be brought to bear locally and internationally for some kind of full reckoning so that the integrity of the church's leadership can someday, it's not going to be tomorrow, someday be restored.
Yeah, I think it's a multi-layered solution. I think, first of all, lay people need to make their voice heard in their own diocese. They need to go to their bishop, in this case, Cardinal Supich, and just request that laity be allowed to review, a lay commission or specific investigators who are trained, not one person, because we've seen when there's one person that oftentimes legitimate issues are just buried. But they need to expose these files and do a thorough review and see what is missing. and begin that conversation about what needs to be fixed. So that needs to happen in every diocese. And I know in some dioceses across the country, there's great receptivity to that on the part of the bishops. They don't want the attorney general to force them to be opening their files. They want to do it themselves. They want to say, hey, let's get to the bottom of this. We don't want this either. So the more the laity can just pressure within their diocese to have this transparency, this willingness to confront the problem, and that's going to be effective. But also supporting Cardinal DiNardo and the efforts of the USCCB to put in place some meaningful procedures, but also, you know, they want the Vatican to respond, because really it's the Vatican who has responsibility for the individual bishops and the cardinals. So, but Cardinal DiNardo and the USCCB, I think, need to hear from Catholics in America saying, you know, push, we want this, we need this. And then I would encourage lay people to sign our letter, Women Want Answers, the letter from women. We're going to send an update with new signatures at the end of this week. There's now a men's letter, Catholic Men United, doing the same thing, close to 10,000 signatures. We have over almost 43,000 signatures. You know, so the Pope needs to hear from us. And I've found that there's a disconnect between the U.S. and Europe, that a lot of people who are over there, I've been talking to a lot of international media over the past week, and they just don't get the turmoil, the drop in people attending Mass, the drop in collections, the anger, the sense that, no, we're not going to let business as usual take over. This needs to be addressed. So that message has got to cross the Atlantic and really penetrate those circles surrounding Pope Francis, who I think are, you know, would prefer to just let things blow over, but it's not. It's not going to blow over.
She is Mary Rice Hassan, Katie O'Byrne Fellow in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and Director of Catholic Women's Forum. Mary, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy O. It'll be fun to see how CBS covers the departure of its president and chief executive officer, Les Moonves, just as it was with respect to Charlie Rose. Moonves, he gone.
Yeah.
Amid sex harassment claims, an initial group of them that were added to in the New Yorker yesterday by Ronan Farrow. Before we get to those, though, let's remember what Julie Chen.
Yes, his wife.
That's his wife. She's one of the people on The View, one of those.
The Talk. And it's on CBS. And she, you know, was very adamant that this is going to be it. I'm only making one statement and one statement only.
And this was the first round of allegations, not this weekend's.
Now, some of you may be aware of what's been going on in my life for the last few days. I issued the one and only statement I will ever make on this topic on Twitter. And I will stand by that statement today, tomorrow, forever. Let's get started with Olympic.
Okay. Yeah.
So what my point of contention is that he resigned, he wasn't fired, and he should have been fired. I mean, within hours after Ronan Farrow's latest article, where it was very descriptive of what he did to six different women, was forced to resign.
Yeah,
or whatever.
I mean, that's being fired.
Yeah, and he's exiting with $100 million. One report says, and $20 million of that he's going to donate to the Me Too movement.
No, he's not. The company.
Oh,
is.
The company.
CBS
is. Okay.
Is. Yeah.
Always a way to make things all better.
Give you an example of the women who are named. So
So these aren't anonymous sources. They came out.
So speaking of news organizations, NBC, let's run this by folks over at NBC. Now, does this meet the standard for publication, NBC, of Ronan Farrow's work? Because I know it didn't when you were flacking for Harvey Weinstein. Let's just remember all the news organizations, none of whom have clean hands on this. One of the women named Phyllis Golden Gottlieb told Farrow she filed a criminal complaint late last year with the L.A. Police Department accusing Moonves of physically restraining her and forcing her to perform oral sex on him and of exposing himself to her and violently throwing her against a wall in later incidents. The two, her and Moonves, worked together in the late 1980s. Law enforcement could not prosecute. They found the allegations credible, consistent, but they couldn't prosecute because the statute of limitations for the crimes had expired. But she goes into detail, in addition to what I just gave you, about what Moonves is alleged to have done to her. And there's Jessica Pallingston, who worked as an assistant to various Warner Brothers executives. And, I mean, this goes on for 13 pages, details, names, and incidents.
Well, during the first round, three of the six, you know, the three, he said, no, that's not true. And the other three, he said, oh, those were consensual relationships. This time around, he's gone. So who's next, Dan?
Well, probably the executive producer at 60 Minutes, who's still on the job, but is facing similar allegations of unwanted advances at minimum at this point. But we'll see. We'll see. And, you know, and this is where a reckoning should obviously come when you're talking about predators like Weinstein, or it certainly appears Moonves and others that have been established, regardless of the targets, Kevin Spacey, others. Okay. And then there's incidents that get sort of folded into all of this, these faux struggles for women's equality, women's rights, because everybody wants a piece of this action. Everybody wants to don the cape and be the hero or heroine. And it seems to me that's the case of Serena Williams over the weekend in the U.S. Open final against Osaka was the young lady's name who won. And Osaka, she was like a Naomi Osaka. Serena Williams is her hero. They're about 16 years apart. But Serena Williams was signaling with her coach from the stands,
which is illegal. You can't do that.
That's violation of the rules. And so she was warned and then penalized, and then she took offense.
This is unbelievable. Every time I play here, I have problems. What? Yeah, that's a warning. I didn't get coaching. You need to make an announcement that I didn't get coaching. I don't cheat. I didn't get coaching. How can you say that? You owe me an apology. You owe me an apology. I have never cheated in my life. I have a daughter and I stand what's right for her, and I've never cheated. And you owe me an apology. You will never do that again.
Does the fact she has a daughter, is that relevant?
Now it makes it personal for her, and she brought that in. That was conjecture. She put that into the story.
I understand what she said. Right. The question is it appropriate? Serena Williams went on to, play the gender card.
It's wrong. You attacking my character. Yes, you are. You owe me an apology. You will never, ever, ever be on another court of mine as long as you live. You are the liar.
And she persisted with the demand for an apology.
And are you going to give me my apology? You owe me an apology. Say it. Say you're sorry.
Now.
Well, then don't talk to me. Don't talk to me.
And after that language got her a game penalty. And then it was time for the gender card.
And that's not right. This is not fair. This has happened to me too many times. This is not fair. This is not fair. But to give me a point to lose a game for what we're saying, that is not fair. I mean, it's really not. But you know how many other men, do things that are, they do much worse than that. This is not fair. There's a lot of men out here that have said a lot of things, and because they're men, that doesn't happen to them. Okay? make the thorough men out here that do life march, but because I'm a woman. Because I'm a woman, you're going to take this away from me? That is not right. You know, and you know it, and I know you can't admit it, but I know you know it's not right. I know you can't change it, but I'm just saying, that's not right. I get the rules. I get the rules, but I'm just saying it's not right.
Hey, Serena, it's not because you're a woman. It's because they expect more decorum and control in the game of tennis. She was fined $10,000 for calling the chair umpire a thief, $4,000 for communicating with her coach, and $3,000 for breaking her racket. People forget that she did that. She destroyed her racket. Now, and that cost her a point, too.
And there's a couple of points of order, speaking of points. One is her coach admitted that he was signaling to her.
Yeah.
So that's not in dispute, and it's a violation of the rules. Some people said it's a stupid rule. Billie Jean King, it's a stupid rule. It shouldn't be a rule. Okay, well, fine, eliminate the rule. But if it's a rule and the umpire calls it, then what are you going to do?
Follow the rules for now.
Number two, this umpire, Carlos Ramos, penalized Novak Djokovic for the same thing, signaling to his coach recently. That's the number one men's tennis player in the world who won the U.S. Open on the men's side. Also, Serena's sister Venus Ford in 2016. So it's a known quantity that this is an issue that he takes perhaps more seriously than other umpires. But that's like in baseball. You know, a particular umpire gives you the outside corner or has a real tight strike zone. That's just different umpires that have different emphases when it comes to umpiring a match or a game. So the argument that this was sexist, it's because she's a woman. By the way, she was playing a woman.
Right.
So I'm trying to follow the logic there. It's a challenge. Is the same thing as would be me saying that the reason she attacked Carlos Ramos is because he's Latino.
Right. I mean, she didn't bring up race. Thank goodness.
No. But I'm bringing it up for him. So why not make the? If we're just going to play identity politics, you don't like a call, you don't like an interchange, so we're immediately going to go to race or gender identity politics. So if we're going to play identity politics, then why not? It has the same intellectual heft as accusing Serena Williams of being anti-Latino. That's why she took out after Carlos Ramos, which is stupid, but so is what she did and what she said.
And now this has empowered her because now she's a spokesperson for women to empower themselves.
I can't sit here and say I wouldn't say he's a thief because I thought he took a game from me, but I've seen other men call other umpires several things, and I'm here fighting for women's rights and for women's equality and for all kinds of stuff. And for me to say thief and for him to take a game, it made me feel like it was a sexist remark. I mean, like how he's never took a game from a man because they said thief.
Yeah, well, first of all, that's not all she said.
For me, it blows my mind. But I'm going to continue to fight for women and to fight for us to have equal. Like Courtney should be able to take her shirt off without getting a fine. Like, this is outrageous.
Everybody burned it. Take your
shirts
off.
And I just feel like the fact that I have to go through this is just an example for the next person that has
emotions
and that want to express themselves and they want to be a strong woman. And they're going to be allowed to do that because of today. Maybe it didn't work out for me, but it's going to work out for the next person.
It wasn't, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't that she used the word thief. It was that went on and on and on.
She couldn't control herself.
Have you ever been to a sporting event? Have you ever seen a manager get ejected? Have you ever seen a coach get a technical and then another technical and get ejected?
Players get ejected, yeah. She should have been ejected.
It's one comment, and that gets you, you know, one level of discipline. And then the discipline increases the more out of line you are. And that's exactly what happened with Serena Williams. Cloak herself in this feminist pablum is so embarrassing. You think she's some kind of great a feminist icon now because she got in a verbal altercation with an umpire?
Because she smashed her racket.
How absurd.
No.
How absurd. A temper tantrum makes you a feminist icon? That's all it was.
She reminded me of she's a female version of John McEnroe. I mean, really, remember his antics on the court when he used to freak out and break his racket?
Well, I'm sure the incidents of her losing her cool are much less in number than McEnroe, but so what? We McEnroe
was penalized for the point I was trying to make is that he was penalized for those outbursts, just like she's being penalized for her outbursts. And the TV analyst that I saw on CNN, the tennis analyst, they agreed with the chair umpire.
And the difference,
because she should have controlled herself.
And the difference is McEnroe didn't make this about some big, political issue. It's not political at all. I mean, it's just so embarrassing. And that people would be cheering this. It's ignorant.
She's got a standing ovation in the press room.
Rob in Ukrainian Village.
She's just abiding by the new calling card. Just do it, even if it means sacrificing everything.
Oh. Yeah, that's right. Thanks for the call, Rob. Huh. And you mean sacrificing a point and then a game and then the match? Although,
then $17,000
again. What did Osaka win? Like 6-2, 6-1 or something? I mean, it was not a close match. But okay, Patty on the Northwest Side.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. What's not being reported is on ESPN, that coach actually did admit that he was giving her coaching, but maybe she didn't see it or whatever. And now another thing is, now this is such a stance for feminists, but who won the match? Another woman that got booed, and nobody's giving her any props. So just like any feminist, anytime they try to say they're working for women, they end up taking more from us.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Yeah, and there's no question she overshadowed Osaka's win.
Men, we don't know what we did.
Melissa in Glenview. Hello, Melissa. Melissa in Glenview.
Yes, hey.
Hey. You're on.
I just wanted to tell Serena that she doesn't speak for all women, but thank you, and that behavior she displayed on the court is not something I would want to teach my daughter on how to behave and very unsportsmanlike. Thanks.
Thanks, Melissa. Noted feminist Sean from Elmwood Park.
He's my favorite feminist.
First off, Amy, are we pretending that the veins in her arms aren't bigger than McEnroe? I mean, are we going to dance around the subject that this is, do you need Mean Gene Okerlund standing next to her and her with a Hulkamania t-shirt on before you realize she's Lou Ferrigno in a tutu? It's roid rage. That's all it is. You can't control yourself, all juiced up. Yeah, that's all it is.
This notion
that we walk around, oh, my God, it's been tiring for 10 years. Michelle Obama's pretty, Barack Obama's not a Marxist, and Serena Williams is feminine. I got it.
Don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
There we go, a little Queensbrake. I like it. Good way to start the week. Dan and Amy, I was watching the Bears-Packers game and another Hall of Fame performance, I should say, from Aaron Rodgers. So we outsource watching the Miss America pageant to Andrew Klavan, Hollywood screenwriter and essayist, author of The Great Good Thing, A Secular Jew Comes to Faith in Christ. Andrew, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
So what did you think of Nia Franklin's rendition of Quando Vengo from La Boheme?
Would you like to hear some of it?
Yeah, I have to be honest. I went out to dinner. I missed the entire thing.
Oh.
So
I know I'm a disappointment to you all. But,
well, they replaced the swimsuit competition after 98 years, as you well know, with a talent competition, okay?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
That may be why I wasn't watching. Yeah. That may actually explain why
Me too.
I wasn't watching.
I prefer the discourse. I like to learn things about climate change and the like from watching those competitions, not pageants.
It's not a it's not a pageant. It's a competition.
Yeah, no, I got it.
Right.
All right. Speaking of things that are certifiable, Andrew, you live in California, and Governor Moonbeam out there getting real aggressive. He must have been motivated by President Obama's remarks on Friday at U of I. California is going to be completely fossil fuel free by 2045. So you better start writing and selling more books to pay your electric bill.
Yeah, well, what I've been doing is I've been gathering sticks so I can heat my home in the winter and, you know, just build a little fire in the middle of the floor. That'll help. And the state is now living in its own imagination. We're living in a world where we can somehow create enough electricity without fossil fuels, which no one seems to ever discuss where this energy is going to come from. It's going to come from the sun, it's going to come from wind, and yet, you know, there's no way to store that energy, so it's no way to use it in the manner that we need it. Most electricity comes from coal. People don't know that, you know, but that's still where it comes from. And it is odd that this state just continues to live at this level of fantasy that is being supported by billionaires in Silicon Valley, some of the best capitalists in the country, who sit around talking about how we should all be socialists. So that's, you know, Hollywood is a capitalist center, and they all sit around on the Bill Maher show talking about how we should all be socialists. And Silicon Valley, expert capitalists, and they all sit around talking about how we should be socialists. So it's basically the state is just one big fantasy land.
Well, I mean, the fun thing would be for them to be the change they wish to see, so wind turbines and solar panels in their backyards.
Yeah, absolutely. What could possibly go wrong, except sometimes the sun goes down. They call it night. We're trying to prevent it. Scientists are working around the clock to prevent it. But so far, no luck.
Do you think that any of the Hollywood elite feel guilty because of their wealth? And they may be like, let's spread things around because they can afford to do that, whereas the average working American, we can't afford it. I mean, what we make, we have to keep because we have children, you know, to take care of.
There is some kind of connection between the massive wealth that you get. I mean, in Hollywood, where I live, if you are a guy who's never done anything for anybody, but you go on television and pretend to be a police officer, you can make $250,000 a week, okay? A week. If you are a police officer, you're making and you're risking your lives for people and you're putting your whole life on the line to keep people safe, you're making $60,000-$70,000 a year, okay? And I think maybe that disjunction does affect people's minds. It does make people think they have to sort of do something. They have to get out and, make it up to people that they are being overpaid the way they are. And plus, artists, I am an artist. We live in our imaginations, you know, and in the imagination, that's the place where socialism works. That's the place where environmentalism works. You know, your imagination is a wonderful, wonderful world. But some of us, even though we are artists, come out of our imaginations and start to say, well, wait, how does reality work? You know, what does socialism do in real life? What does, climate change, panic and hysteria do in real life? And I just think it's just too easy. It is just too easy to stand up at an Oscar speech where you've been paid for reading somebody's lines convincingly and you get a prize for it. It's just too tempting to stand up there and make some heroic speech as if you had performed some action other than pretending to be someone. It used to be when actors came to town, people locked up their daughters. They understood that they were talented people, but they also understood that they weren't very good citizens. And now we honor them and elevate them to such a level that, and yet they're still the same people they always were. You know, you still should lock up your daughters when the actors come to town. But we elevate them to such a level they think they know more than they do.
Speaking of culture and socialism, the bread and circuses of athletics, your reaction to the Nike Kaepernick campaign and sort of the, you know, the rolling controversy in the NFL now that the season has kicked off about kneelers and the flag and the like?
You know, I'm a huge football fan, and I cannot bring myself to watch an NFL football game as long as they are refusing to enforce their own rules about disrespecting the flag. And this is not just jingoism. It really isn't. Sports has always, everywhere, been a national pastime and a unifying event. You know, it has always been since ancient Greece, the sports were meant to bring people together in a national way. And when you go out and you disrespect the flag, when you honor a second-rate guy like Colin Kaepernick, I mean, he was a second-rate quarterback, and the way he talks and the things he says about the country that has supported him, he's not being a first-rate human being when he does that. When you put him as the face of your product and you stand by that, even if your sales go up, I don't care whether your sales go up or down, and when you kneel and you disrespect the flag, and when you make excuses for Serena Williams behaving badly on the court, which she's done all her career, you're really telling people, the people who are at home watching, that that we are here for them instead of them being here for us. You know, they forget who pays them. They forget who pays their salary. They forget who's there to watch them. The NFL is failing only because of these behaviors. The NFL is losing audience only because of these behaviors. And on top of it, their behaviors are wrong. I mean, if you are a person who thinks that you are oppressed in America, that the police are somehow abusing you in your community or abusing your community, you are appealing to me as your fellow American to care. You are saying to me, I'm not getting my American rights. For me to care, I have to know that you are my brother American. We can disagree. We can look at things differently. But we've got to be united, at least in that we are both Americans and that we both stand by those values. When you disrespect the flag, you're basically saying to me, screw you, screw your country. And I'm going to say the same thing back to you. I'm going to say, I don't care what your problems are. You're not one of me. You're not one of mine. You're not a fellow American. What do I need? Why should I support you? So it's divisive in every possible way. I think they hurt themselves. I really do. And it's a shame because I love watching football, but I cannot watch these millionaire sports players, you know, disrespect the country that makes them what they are.
You didn't watch any football this weekend?
Yeah, I tried to. I turned it on the Chargers game, and
that's tough to watch. That's just tough to watch. Period.
They're supposed to be good this year. But how long did you last?
It really is a shame. I love the sport.
Yeah. I wanted to get your take on something that Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse said over the weekend about he considers leaving the Republican Party daily because he's sick of the soap opera that is occurring within the Trump administration from his perspective. And also David French over at National Review wrote this, and particularly interesting to get your response since you're the author of The Great Good Thing, A Secular View Comes to Faith in Christ. David French writing, I no longer consider myself a Republican. I'm a Christian and a conservative who evaluates each race on the merits, and I'm happy to vote third party when appropriate. The R by a name no longer indicates that the candidate likely shares my values or political goals. That's long been the case in Illinois for me, but I wonder what your response is to Sasse and French.
Well, David French is I know David. He's a good guy, good man, and I've disagreed with him ever since the election of Trump. You know, again, we don't live in our imaginations. We live in reality. In reality, there are two parties. One party is closer to moving toward constitutional liberty. The other one is dedicated to moving away from it. There's no question in my mind anymore that the left, the Democrats, are no longer responsible to the Constitution and to the vision of America, where people are free, where people govern themselves. So you really don't have that much of a choice, you know? And I think that the people, the commentariat, and the people in the Beltway and the people who are wrapped up in politics are losing sight of the goals here. President Trump, you know, an obstreperous guy, a guy I have a lot of problems with, a guy I don't always like, his administration is doing a great job. Now, maybe it's being run by some anonymous, unelected New York Times op-ed writer. I don't think so. I don't think so. The things that have come out of this administration are exactly the things President Trump promised when he was running. So somewhere along the line, he is the generator and engine of the change that we are seeing in this country. And the change has been amazing. I mean, when you have jobs being created so rapidly that wages finally are starting to rise, when you have us largely pulled out of all the entangling wars we were in, all these things are beautiful things, and we're supposed to miss them. We're supposed to be worried because he has a chaotic governing style or that he's a mean guy. I'm not John Kelly. I don't have to worry about him. John Kelly has a hard time going to work in the morning. That's not my problem. You know, I have people to support. I have a job to do. I have a life to live. So this idea that somehow the rest of us are supposed to become hysterical over Trump's governing style is absurd. And, you know, Bob Woodward, you know, good reporter, he can go out there and tell me that the world is going to explode because of a tweet, which is essentially what he's been saying to sell his book. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. I don't see the world exploding. I see the world getting more peaceful. I see our economy booming. I see judges being appointed who are dedicated to the Constitution. I see regulations being dialed back. I see factory jobs that weren't supposed to ever come back coming back. So I just don't care. I don't think any of us should care if President Trump is an obstreperous loudmouth, which he obviously is. I mean, I don't understand outside the Beltway, outside the fever swamp of Washington and the commentariat, why that's the problem. So To David French at this point, I would just say, look, we play the cards we're dealt. You know, I wish we were voting for Abe Lincoln, too. We're not. I wish we had a choice. You know, when the Democrats make fun of us for voting for Donald Trump, I always remind them who he was running against. He was running against Ma Barker, you know. He wasn't running against George Washington. So, I mean, you know, we play the cards we're dealt, and that's the way I feel about David French. As for Sasse, Sasse made one of the greatest speeches, two-minute speeches I ever heard during the Kavanaugh hearings about how we have to get back to the Constitution and how we have to get back to Schoolhouse Rock, basic learning about how the government's supposed to work. He is absolutely right about this. And I understand his feelings, but he should step back, too, and ask himself, what are the results of his actions? What are the results of his actions? There are only two operational parties, and the other party is becoming increasingly socialist, increasingly dedicated to silencing the opposition in every venue they can. They are opposed to the Second Amendment. They're opposed to the First Amendment. Where is he going to go? If he's not a Republican, what is he going to be? Now, you can argue that there should be a third party and go ahead and try it. I'd be happy to, you know, see it happen. But right now, the only thing he can do by leaving the party is hurt the country. And so if those are, you know, you got to play the cards you're dealt. You really do. You have to live in reality. And I think these guys are living, again, in their imaginations of what reality can be. And I do not think that that's a very good idea right now.
Real quick, before we let you go, what do you think of President Trump's hunt for the op-ed author?
Kind of a waste of time. The guy's probably a low-level State Department toady. The line in the op-ed about John McCain and worshiping John McCain was kind of a giveaway. I don't think he's a very important person. I think it's very possible that Trump could get obsessed with something like that. He strikes me as the kind of person who might get obsessed with it. But really, who cares? I mean, there are always these guys. There are always underlings who think they run the place. In every big organization, there's some guy who thinks, you know, without me, this place couldn't operate. I'm the guy who's really doing it. I think it's just, you know, it's just a ruse by the New York Times and the rest of the left to make us panic about a great time in American history. It should have been 2 years of peace and prosperity, and they just want to make sure that they keep the panic level high, especially going into the midterms.
He is Andrew Klavan. You can catch a daily podcast at the Daily Wire, the Andrew Klavan Show. Also, a number of books that were made into motion pictures, True Crime, Don't Say a Word, and his most recent offering, The Great Good Thing, A Secular Jew Comes to Faith in Christ. Andrew, thanks, as always, for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, wouldn't it be more fun if all these diminutive Chicago politicians were transformed into Lord of the Rings characters?
It would be.
I mean, yeah.
From the lollipop king to that.
Exactly.
They take on a little more sinister role or a look.
Bring out the Legolas in Mike Madigan. Bring out the Galadriel in John Cullerton. And I got the woman who can do it. Her name is Kimberell. She is on a mission. She's named Project Elvenstar, which involves helping humans transform into high elves by elevating their consciousness. She dresses as a high elf as much as she can, and as she says, in velvet, silk, ornate, detailed, or nature-inspired clothing. I have about 5 different types of elf ears and cuffs I wear, plus my own ears.
To see elf ears.
Plus my own ears have a. You know who has elven ears?
Oh, who?
I noticed this last night at halftime. Tony Dungy.
Oh, you're right.
It's weird.
Yeah, he's got the pointy. Yeah.
Maybe he lives life as a high elf these days. I don't know. She says she wants humanity to grow up organically and move forwards into a brighter age of experience that lives peacefully with nature and advanced technology for all to experience. So, yeah, you got that option for all of our Munchkin, Shetland, Chicago Democrats, which at least would be more entertaining to see them walking around
in elf suits
like that. I mean,
I like my elves as Christmas elves.
Now, if she could make me look like Orlando Bloom. Yeah. Then we could talk.
Oh, okay.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773 467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.